The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 26, 2022/January 9, 2023. Typically, it is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. The background of the cover is gray with Time in very large white block letters superimposed upon that background. Front and center is the image of this year's, or rather last year's, Person of the Year, Volodymyr Zelensky, and the Spirit of Ukraine. The face, neck, and shoulders of Zelensky are surrounded by other people, mostly dressed in blue, male and female, mostly in the middle age category, I would guess, with more crowds in the background and the foreground. There are several blue and yellow Ukrainian flags positioned on the cover, a blue horizontal stripe on the top, and an equally sized yellow horizontal stripe beneath the blue. There are also sunflowers scattered about on this image, and they're the national flower of the Ukraine. Zelensky here looks youthful, although I believe he is of middle age. He has finely clipped brown hair and finely trimmed brown facial hair. He's looking just a bit askance at an angle from the camera lens. He's neither smiling nor frowning. That we will tackle the cover story, the Person of the Year, Volodymyr Zelensky. It's lengthy, so I may abridge it. 2022 Person of the Year, Volodymyr Zelensky, and the Spirit of Ukraine. The Choice by Edward Felsenthal, Editor-in-Chief. I'll read the first two paragraphs here. The process of choosing the person of the year, who or what most influenced the events of the past 12 months, for good or for ill, can be agonizing. How could one person represent an entire year? Do we lean into the light, reach into the darkness, or land somewhere in between? This year's choice was most clear-cut in memory. Whether the battle for Ukraine fills one with hope or with fear, Volodymyr Zelensky galvanized the world in a way we have not seen in decades. In the weeks after Russian bombs began falling, February 24, his decision not to flee Kiev but to stay and rally support was fateful. From his first 40-second Instagram post, February 25, showing that his cabinet and civil society were intact and in place, to daily speeches delivered remotely to the likes of Houses of Parliament, the World Bank, and Grammy Awards, Ukraine's president was everywhere. His information offensive shifted the geopolitical weather system, setting off a wave of action that swept the globe. Allow me now to spell Zelensky's name. The first name is V-O-L-O-D-Y-M-Y-R. The last name, Z-E-L-E-N-S-K-Y. 2022 Person of the Year, Volodymyr Zelensky, by Simon Schuster, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw, New York. The call from the president's office came on a Saturday evening. Be ready to go the next day, an aide said, and pack a toothbrush. There were no details about the destination or how we would get there, but it was not difficult to guess. Only 2 days earlier, on the 260th day, 260, of the invasion of Ukraine, the Russians had retreated from the city of Kherson. It was the only regional capital they had managed to seize since the start of the all-out war in February, and the Kremlin had promised it would forever be a part of Russia. Now Kherson was free, and Volodymyr Zelensky wanted to get there as soon as possible. His bodyguards were urging him to wait. The Russians had destroyed the city's infrastructure, leaving it with no water, power, or heat. Its outskirts were littered with mines. Government buildings were rigged with tripwires. On the way to Kherson, an explosion had destroyed a bridge, rendering it impassable. As they fled, the Russians were also suspected of leaving behind agents and saboteurs who could try to ambush the presidential convoy to assassinate Zelensky or take him hostage. There would be no way to ensure his safety on the central square, where crowds had gathered to celebrate the city's liberation within range of Russian artillery. My security was 100% against it, the president told me during the trip. They took it hard. They cannot control practically anything in a region that has just been deoccupied. So it is a big risk, and on my part, a bit reckless. Then why do it? The Russian goal at the start of the invasion had been to kill or capture Zelensky and decapitate his government. Why give them a chance to strike? The obvious reason had to do with the information war, which had become Zelensky's specialty. By rolling into the city that Vladimir Putin still claimed as his own, the leader of Ukraine would blow a hole through the stories of conquest and imperial glory that Russian propagandists had been using for months to justify the war. Zelensky's visit would deepen the embarrassment of the Russian retreat and strengthen the Ukrainian will to carry on through the winter. But that was not the reason he gave for the trip. It is the people, he told me in a two-hour interview on his private train rolled through the country. 9 months they've been under occupation without light, without anything. Yes, they've had 2 days of euphoria over their return to Ukraine, but those 2 days are over. Soon the long road to recovery would come into view, and many of his citizens would want a return to normality much faster than the state can deliver it. They are going to fall into a depression now, and it will be very hard, Zelensky explained. As I see it, it is my duty to go there and show them Ukraine has returned. It supports them. Maybe it will give them enough of a boost to last a few more days, but I'm not sure. I do not lull myself with such illusions. Our rendezvous point for the trip was outside a firehouse, in a part of central Kyiv that was without electricity when the photographer and I arrived the following evening. Russian missiles have damaged or destroyed much of Ukraine's power grid since the start of October, a concerted effort to make the winter as painful as possible for the civilian population. People out walking their dogs use their phones to light the sidewalks. Even the central bazaar was in darkness, though the vendors inside were still selling fresh fruit and cheese, pickles and pork belly by the glow of electric lanterns. When we passed them, lugging our bulletproof vests and helmets, we made sure to grab some food for the road. Bring snacks, one of Zelensky's aides had warned in a text message. These trips tend to be very disorganized. You would not know it from the black van that arrived to pick us up, as agreed, at 7:30 p.m. on the dot and brought us through the checkpoints that surround the government district. The area had become familiar to me since the start of the invasion. For nearly 9 months, Zelensky's team had allowed me to spend much of my time here, working inside the presidential compound and reporting on the ways they've experienced the war and how it has transformed them and him The blackouts give the place a haunted look. Soldiers peered out of pillboxes hidden among the trees. Flashlight beams flickered in the window of Zelensky's office on the fourth floor. "Do you have documents on you?" asked one of the guards. "Good. Then we'll know how to mark your grave if you fall behind the convoy." The joke made his comrades double over with laughter. That night, the presidential train took about 9 hours to travel the length of Ukraine from north to south. Most of the compartments were taken up by the security men who rested their assault rifles on the luggage racks, kicked up their feet, watched movies on their phones. They had never seen reporters on this train before, and their only request was that we not take any photos of Zelensky's private carriage. "If the Russians find it, that's a bullseye," one of them explained. Since the start of the invasion, air traffic over Ukraine has been limited to fighter jets, drones, bombers, and cruise missiles. The train has become the president's primary means of long-distance travel. From the outside, his carriage is indistinguishable from a regular passenger car. Inside, my expectations of a high-tech command center on wheels, or at least a well-stocked bar, did not pan out. There was no internet on board, and the amenities were modest. A first-class ticket on Amtrak would offer more space to stretch out, but Zelensky says he enjoys the train. It gives him time to read, and the experience reminds him of his childhood. When he was growing up, his father worked as a systems manager in the copper mines of Mongolia, and the trips to visit him would take 8 days on the railroad from their hometown of Kryvyi, that's Kryvyi, in central Ukraine, passing all the way through Russia and Siberia. He remembers the journeys fondly, the vast expanses of the Soviet Empire rolling by, the glasses of tea served in metal cup holders embossed with the hammer and sickle. It is among the many ironies of his predicament that Zelensky was raised in the empire, whose revival he's now fighting to stop. For most of his life, he felt nostalgia for the culture and history Ukraine shared with Russia. "There were these amazing Soviet comedies," Zelensky told me. Among his heroes growing up were filmmakers like Leonid Gadai, whose works were heavily censored, but still charming and often hilarious. One depicted Ivan the Terrible swapping lives with a superintendent at a Soviet apartment building. "These are the classics of my generation, but I'm incapable of watching them now," the president says. "They revolt me." Memories of his youth are now colored by the atrocities that Russian forces committed this year in service of Moscow's imperial ambitions. In April, less than 2 months into the invasion, Zelensky told me he had aged and changed from all this wisdom that I never wanted. Now, half a year later, the transformation was starker. Aides who once saw him as a lightweight now praise his toughness. Slights that might once have upset him now elicit no more than a shrug. Some of his allies miss the old Zelensky, the practical joker with the boyish smile. But they realize he needs to be different now. He's much harder and deaf to distractions, or else his country might not survive. Early in the morning, the train came to a stop in an industrial lot in the region of Mykolaiv, where a convoy of vans and SUVs was waiting to drive us the rest of the way to Kherson. The devastation of the war soon appeared on both sides of the highway, bus stops pocked with shrapnel gashes, twisted shells of bombed-out buildings, a family restaurant in the shape of a castle that looked as if it had been strafed with a chain gun. The damage around Mykolaiv was worse than in most of the country, because it was here the Ukrainians managed to stop the Russian advance from the south in March. A dozen or so governors, ministers, and generals were waiting on Kherson's central square when we arrived. They posed and took selfies in front of the graffiti scrawled on the facade of the regional parliament. Glory to the armed forces of Ukraine. Glory to the heroes. One of Zelensky's aides, Dasha Tsarivna, grew up in Kherson, and she looked close to tears as she gazed at the Ukrainian flags flying over the square. "I was scared I'd never seen this place again," she told me, and here we are. The first explosion sounded a few minutes later. Everyone froze, looking up at the sky for a shell to come arcing down. Then came another boom, which sounded closer than the first. Someone suggested it was outgoing artillery fire, though this seemed more like an optimistic guess. The Russians had retreated to the left bank of the Dnipro River, about a mile away. The blasts continued to sound, but Zelensky did not seem bothered by them. He declined, as usual, to wear a helmet or bulletproof vest. I'm stopping here now to read the captions of six photos that take up two-thirds of two pages. I will not describe them in detail. Allow me to indicate, though, that all look stark. Some are in the backdrop of winter with bare trees, some barely spring with some green leafage. Mostly it is very stark. One shows an evacuating family in their car with a sign that reads, "Children." There is a sign taped to the back door in a language I do not understand, but it apparently says children. Next, a wounded soldier at a hospital in the Donbas region. Next, exhuming mass graves near Izium. On the bottom row, then, from left to right, Ukrainian soldiers in the Donetsk region. Next, firefighters clear debris from a Kharkiv building damaged by an airstrike, and finally, inside a bomb shelter beneath a children's hospital in the first days of invasion. It shows a slender young woman holding a small child, an infant, that is hooked up to some kind of contraption that looks like an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. Oh, it's hooked up by an IV. On to the text of the story. At the end of the square, the soldiers had installed a Starlink internet terminal, plugging its satellite antenna into a diesel generator. The president took out his phone and asked for the Wi-Fi password. Most of the people around him were armed with assault weapons, but this was his weapon, a late-model iPhone Zelensky has used to wage the biggest land war in the information age. His skill at addressing the world through that phone, in his nightly speeches on social media, in his endless calls with foreign leaders and supporters, has been as critical as the number of tanks in his army. Zelensky's dialed into the World Economic Forum in Davos and the NATO summit in Madrid. He's granted interviews to talk show hosts and journalists and held live chats with students at Stanford, Harvard, and Yale. He's leveraged the fame of entertainment superstars to amplify his calls for international support. Jessica Chastain and Ben Stiller visited his fortified compound. Liev Schreiber agreed to become an ambassador for Ukraine's official fundraising platform. Sean Penn brought an Oscar statuette to Kiev and left it with Zelensky. Once the president allowed a team of technicians to create a 3D hologram of his likeness, which was later projected at conferences around Europe. "Our principle is simple," said Andriy Yermak, the president's chief of staff. "If we fall out of focus, we're in danger. The attention of the world serves as a shield." The effect has been a kind of virtual omnipresence that has at times grown tedious for some of Zelensky's own citizens. "We're always looking for new formats," says Krylo, Tymoshenko, presidential advisor who oversees the TV marathon, beaming Zelensky's message into Ukrainian homes. But sooner or later, people get tired of the flood of news, and they have started tuning out. The liberation of Kherson gave the nation a rare chance to celebrate. A crowd had gathered in the center of the square, and someone shouted, "Glory to Ukraine!" The response was a chorus, mostly women's voices, "Glory to the heroes." To the frustration of his security, Zelensky went over to greet them, and the throng surged forward as he approached. Reporters rushed up from behind, locking the president in a crush that his guards could not control. One soldier, his back to the president, had terror in his eyes as he scanned the faces in the crowd for threats. Zelensky smiled and waved. "How are you?" he said. "You all right?" Zelensky's success as a wartime leader has relied on the fact that courage is contagious. It spread through Ukraine's political leadership in the first days of the invasion, as everyone realized the president had stuck around. If that seems like a natural thing for a leader to do in a crisis, consider historical precedent. Only 6 months earlier, the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, a far more experienced leader than Zelensky, fled his capital as Taliban forces approached. In 2014, one of Zelensky's predecessors, Viktor Yanukovych, ran away from Kyiv as protesters closed in on his residence. He still lives in Russia today. Early in the Second World War, the leaders of Albania, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Greece, Poland, Netherlands, Norway, and Yugoslavia, among others, led the advance of the German Wehrmacht and lived out the war in exile. There was not much in Zelensky's biography to predict his willingness to stand and fight. He'd never served in the military or shown much interest in its affairs. He'd only been president since April 2019. His professional instincts derived from a lifetime as an actor on the stage, a specialist in improv comedy, and a producer in the movie business. That experience turned out to have its advantages. Zelensky was adaptable, trained not to lose his nerve under pressure. He knew how to read a crowd and react to its moods and expectations. Now his audience was the world. He was determined not to let them down. His decision to stay at the compound in the face of possible assassination set an example, making it more difficult for his underlings to cut and run. Anyone who left is a traitor. Ruslan Stefanchuk, the Speaker of Ukraine's parliament, told its members a few hours after the invasion started. Instead of running for their lives, many Ukrainians grabbed whatever weapons they could find and ran to defend their towns and cities against an invading force armed with tanks and attack helicopters. Military theory does not account for regular dudes with track pants and hunting rifles. Ukraine's top military commander, General Valery Zaluzhny, told me in describing the defense of Kyiv during the invasion's first weeks. How much credit does Zelensky deserve for that defense? In the early hours of the invasion, the president was informed Russia was attempting to fly thousands of troops to the gates of Kyiv in military cargo planes, and he gave orders to stop those planes from landing at any cost. One of his advisors, Mykhailo Podolyak, has never seen his boss that furious. He gave the harshest possible orders: show no mercy. Use all available weapons. But the armed forces of Ukraine did not need special dispensation to defend the airport where the Russian planes were headed. The machinery of Ukraine's resistance was already in motion. Zelensky was not at the wheel. He had spent months downplaying the risk of a full-scale invasion, even as U.S. intelligence agencies warned it was imminent. When it started, He gave his generals the freedom to lead on the battlefield and focused instead on the dimension of the war where he could be most effective, persuading the world that Ukraine must win at any cost. "Do prove that you are with us," he said in a speech to the European Parliament the first week of the invasion. "Do prove that you will not let us go. Do prove that you are indeed Europeans, and then life will win over death and light will win over darkness." From here on, I'm going to be skipping through this long article to its terminus. From Kherson's central square, the presidential convoy headed out of the city, making stops along the way to honor and acknowledge its defenders. The first was a ceremony where Zelensky handed out medals to a few dozen soldiers, including at least one American volunteer who had participated in the city's liberation. Another was a warehouse converted into a hub for humanitarian aid, piled high with boxes of canned fish, toilet paper, vegetable oil, and spaghetti. The workers went about their business as Zelensky looked around. One man at the wheel of a forklift seemed annoyed when the presidential entourage got in his way, and the machine beeped loudly as we tried to maneuver around him. When it comes to battlefield decisions, Zelensky usually focuses on human lives. How many would be lost if we take this path? We could have pushed into Kherson earlier with greater force, but we understood how many people would have fallen, he says. That's why a different tactic was chosen, and thank God it worked. I don't think it was some genius move on our part. It was reason winning out, wisdom winning out against speed and ambition. The sun was close to setting by the time we got back to the train. Its locomotive idled at a distance from the nearest station. On normal days, if any wartime days can be considered normal, Zelensky and his staff are in a perpetual hurry. They speak to each other in bursts of information, status reports, military briefings, jumping from one agenda item to the next. The routine slows when they're traveling. The train creeps along at a dreary pace on purpose. In case of a rocket strike on one of the wagons, the others would sustain less damage at that speed, and more passengers would be likely to survive. "It gives us a chance to speak in peace," says Denis Monastirsky, the Minister of Interior, who's accompanied the President on some of his trips. "We talk about our private worries, our families, our kids." For most of the year, Zelensky lived apart from his wife and their two children. The main reason is security. His presence would put them at greater risk. But he also feels it would be wrong to resume their domestic habits while so many Ukrainian families remain separated by the war. Millions of refugees from Ukraine are living abroad, mostly women and children. While men of fighting age are prohibited from leaving the country without special permission, which is not granted readily under the terms of martial law. Still, Zelensky sees his family much more often now than in the first weeks of the war. During a recent visit, his 9-year-old son, Kirillo, surprised his father with his expertise in military matters. Zelensky seemed proud of the boy's new interests. "He studies it all. He looks it up online. He talks to the bodyguards," the president told me. "He's a fan of our armed forces, our army, and knows deeply what our mission is, what we are liberating, what weapons we have, what we're missing." More photos here. Again, I will read only the captions and not finite descriptions. They look less dreary here. It's a spread of 4 sizable photographs. There is some darkness. There are some gray skies. There's also a very green field. Now, that's all the description you get, and I'll read the captions. "Two friends, ages 10 and 11, establish a checkpoint near their damaged homes in the Kharkiv region." And these 10 and 11-year-olds are holding rifles, and they look pretty serious. The next photo is a singular person, Stefania, 95, lives in a bomb shelter in the city of Chuchuif. She's got lots of pillows and bolsters stuffed behind her and beside her. It looks like she's sitting on a wooden bench with a side and a back. Then down below, an older fellow in a outside a brick building with a tin roof, corrugated roof. It's Volodymyr, 76, who cooks in the courtyard of his home in the village of Vilkifa. And finally, the green. There's no sky showing in this photo, nor was there in the bomb shelter photo. It's all green except the remains of a destroyed Russian helicopter in the village of Malaya Rohan in May. And sitting on what looks to me like an engine that's kind of bashed about, a boy. He looks like he's about 10. He's got a blonde crew cut, and he's wearing black attire, a shirt and pants, and black slip-on shoes. Now I'm skipping farther ahead to end the story. I asked whether history had in some ways hardened Ukraine as a nation, contributing to its resolve in fighting the present war. The question earned me a piercing look. Some people might say it hardened us, but I think it took away so much of Ukraine's ability to develop. Zelensky says, they're talking here about the past connection with the Soviet Union. It was one blow after another, the hardest kind. How does that harden us? People barely survived. Hunger broke them. It broke their psyches. And of course, that leaves a trace. I don't want to weigh who has more tanks and armies, he says. Russia is a nuclear superpower. No matter how many times its forces are made to retreat from Ukrainian cities, they can regroup and try again. We're dealing with a powerful state that is pathologically unwilling to let Ukraine go, Zelensky told me. They see the democracy and freedom of Ukraine as a question of their own survival. The only way to defeat an enemy like that, not just to win a temporary truce, but to win the war, is to persuade the rest of the free world to pull Ukraine in the other direction, toward sovereignty, independence, and peace. The loss of freedom in one nation, he argues, erodes freedom in all the rest. If they devour us, the sun in your sky will get dimmer. It was approaching midnight when we arrived back in Kiev. The president's carriage stopped next to a gap in a concrete wall, behind which another convoy of cars was waiting to take him back to his office. Before dawn, Zelensky was due to give a speech to the G20 summit in Bali, where the war in Ukraine topped the agenda. Despite the role Russia plays in the group, its envoys were being ostracized by many of their peers in Bali, and its foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, decided to go home early. The Russians need to understand, Zelensky told me. They will have no forgiveness. They will have no acceptance in the world. Just before 3 a.m., Zelensky took his seat in the Situation Room on the second floor of the presidential compound. A golden trident, the state symbol of Ukraine, hung on the wall behind him. He was dressed in his usual olive-green T-shirt when the cameras turned on. "Greetings," he said, "to the world's majority, which is with us." The battle to liberate Kherson was over, he announced, and it was reminiscent of history's great military victories, like the Allied landing on Normandy on D-Day, which turned the tide of World War II. That was not yet a final point in the fight against evil, but it already determined the further course of events. That is exactly what we're feeling now. Now, Kherson is free. But his vision of victory now extends beyond the liberation of territory. In our interview on the way back from Kherson, Zelensky stressed this year's invasion is just the latest Russian attempt over the past century to subjugate Ukraine. His intention is to make it the last, even if it takes a lot more time and sacrifice. It's far too early to gauge whether that goal can be reached, Zelensky told me. Later we will be judged. I have not finished this great, important action for our country. Not yet. Simon Schuster wrote that lengthy article, which was abridged, but not much, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw, New York. Best of Culture, this is what I'll share with you for the next 2 minutes. Movies by Stephanie Zakarik, The Fablemans, F-A-B-E-L-M-A-N-S. Steven Spielberg's been making movies for more than 50 years, and there are autobiographical touches in many of them. But The Fablemans is his most personal film to date, one that reckons with the bittersweet truth of how families endure, even in the midst of stress and crisis. Michelle Williams and Paul Dano star as Mitzi and Bert Fableman, stand-ins for Spielberg's real-life parents. Their performances are among the year's best, delicately textured and deeply moving. 2. After Sun, A-F-T-E-R-S-U-N, one word. As kids, we have no idea how our feelings about our parents will take shape when we ourselves are grown up. That's the territory Scottish writer-director Charlotte Wells explores in her stunning debut. 11-year-old Sophie, Frankie Corio, goes on a rare holiday break with her father, Callum, the extraordinary Paul Mescal, during which she begins to see his flaws and his suffering. The subtle aftershocks of this intimate, beautifully wrought picture linger long after you've finished watching it. 3. Armageddon Time. In this semi-autobiographical drama from James Gray, a smart but smart-alecky Queens sixth grader, Banks Repetta's Paul befriends one of the few black kids in his class, Jalen Webb's Johnny, even as he remains clueless about the specific realities of his friend's life. Humans like to brag about the times they did the right thing, but memories of the times we failed to act are the most haunting of all. Gray reckons with those failures and does not offer easy self-forgiveness. 4. Elvis. Baz Luhrmann's Elvis is less a straightforward biopic of Elvis Presley than a sequined jumpsuit in movie form, impractical but flattering, built to accommodate giant leaps of imagination. Austin Butler, his eyes as soft as a sigh of longing, conjures both the carnal majesty and the dreamy sadness of Elvis. This movie's nuts, but it's also filled with love for a king we did not deserve. 5. Happening. Even if it were not so timely, French director Audrey Diwan's Happening would still be a tense and quietly radical piece of work. Adapted from the 2000 memoir by Annie Ernaux, the picture's both forthright and moving in its exploration of what an unwanted pregnancy can mean to a woman. 6. Tar. Cate Blanchett's turn as tyrannical, magnificent, and fictional orchestra conductor Lydia Tar is so vivid you would almost believe she's a real person. Todd Field has made an ambitious film about the ruthlessness of artists, but it's also about art as sustenance, fuel for survival in a sometimes merciless world. Television by Judy Berman. 1. Better Call Saul. One of TV's most visually gorgeous, carefully plotted, emotionally involving sagas ended this year with the finale of Breaking Bad prequel, Better Call Saul. Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould's lawyer show about this inevitable perversion of justice surpassed even its predecessor, thanks largely to superb lead performances by Bob Odenkirk and Rhea Seehorn as two characters trying to be good people who cannot find a way to be good together. For all its blood and death, Saul was the most fundamentally humanistic drama of its time. From AMC. 2. The Rehearsal. In the year's best nonfiction show, Nathan For You, creator and star Nathan Fielder, helped regular people rehearse for tough encounters. Well, that was the premise. Then things got messy, calling into question the extent of Fielder's behind-the-scenes manipulations, how acclimated viewers had become to the routine deceptions of reality TV, and whether we can game out real-life risks without harming those we enlist to help. That was from HBO. Severance. First-time creator Dan Erickson's dystopia about workers who have their consciousnesses surgically bifurcated is not just a sharp satire of corporate overreach, it's proof. There's still room on TV for ambitious, original, character-driven dramas that take on urgent social issues. From Apple TV+. 4. Reservation Dogs. Sterling Hario and Taika Waititi's groundbreaking dramedy about teens growing up on an Oklahoma reservation in the wake of their lifelong friend's suicide could not have gotten off to a stronger start last year. Even so, the show improved in its sophomore season, using viewers' familiarity with the Rez dogs, their families, and other local characters to expand its funny, poignant portrait of the community. From FX. This is going to hurt. Number 5. In its unvarnished depiction of inequality in healthcare, this British import starring Ben Whishaw as an overworked OBGYN at a public hospital brought rare honesty to a cliche-ridden medical drama genre that celebrates hero doctors at the expense of telling the truth about their real-life counterparts' working conditions. But it is not all misery. It preserves the biting humor of its source material. A memoir by Adam Kay, and Whishaw disappears into the role of a prickly, young, gay man with one foot out of the closet. From AMC+. 6. Better Things. An auteur's magnum opus, a very funny comedy, an art film for the small screen, a sharp commentary on Hollywood misogyny and ageism, the best show about single motherhood. Pamela Adlon's Better Things was all of this in its final season. Just as her alter ego was always jiggling responsibilities, Adlon juggled her character's internal lives, holding space for each perspective. From FX. Books by Annabelle Guterman. First of all, the fiction. And by the way, I am abridging these columns to the 6 out of 10 or more entries. Fiction, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, Gabriel Zevin's sweeping novel, follows the decades-long friendship between two video game designers who become household names before they turn 25. As the duo wrestle with their growing ambitions, Zevin unveils a devastating narrative about identity and art and depicts a creative partnership that is much more meaningful than any romance. 2. Remember, this is fiction in books. The hero of this book, Elizabeth McCracken, delivers a potent meditation on processing loss through the fictional, or is it, story of an unnamed writer coping with his mother's recent death. McCracken, who shares many life experiences with her narrator, makes startling revelations about how fiction can reveal the biggest truths about life and what it really means to write. 3. The Book of Goose, G-O-O-S-E. In Yi Young Lee's taut novel, Anye has just learned her childhood best friend is dead, forcing her to reflect on their codependent relationship and strange coming of age in wartime France. Lee, L.I., builds a dark fairy tale like world with suspenseful twists and turns as Anye wrestles with her past and wonders how much of her identity belongs to someone else. 5. All This Could Be Different. The tender debut novel from Sarah Tankham Matthews centers on Sneha, S-N-E-H-A, a recent college graduate navigating her new life in the Midwest. As Sneha finally faces deeply buried trauma, an incisive coming-of-age narrative emerges. 5. Vladimir. The snarky protagonist of Julia Mae Jonas's Electric debut novel is a college professor who is crushing hard on her department's new recruit. As she grows closer to the recent hire, her desire overtakes her, an obsession that Jonas captures in this wild narrative about power and politics on campus. 6. If I Survive You. The 8 linked stories in Jonathan Escoffery's kaleidoscopic debut collection center on Trelawney, the son of Jamaican immigrants living in Miami. Escoffery writes with urgency and heart as he illustrates his protagonist's struggles to fit in, especially as his family falls apart in the wake of a devastating hurricane and recession. More reviews by Annabelle Guterman. Nonfiction. This column features nonfiction books, titles. One in Love. After Amy Bloom's husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, she supported him through the decision to end his life on his own terms. Her memoir is a beautiful tribute to their marriage and a crucial reminder of the relationship between grief and love. 2. South to America. Imani Perry takes a tour of the American South to argue associations made with those states, with racism at their core, are essential to understanding the country as a whole. The result is a revelatory account of the South's ugly past, the Civil War, slavery, Jim Crow laws, and how that history still reverberates today. 3. Ducks. In her graphic memoir, Kate Beaton reflects on her time working in the Canadian oil fields to pay off her student loans. Beaton makes stunning observations about the intersections of class, gender, and capitalism. 4. The Escape Artist. Jonathan Friedland's biography of Rudolf Virba, V-R-B-A, one of the first Jews to break out of Auschwitz, spares no detail about the Holocaust's brutalities. It is a skillfully rendered look inside the journey of a 19-year-old who risked his life to warn the world about what he endured. 5. An Immense World. Journalist Ed Young, Y-O-N-G,'s book is a celebration of sights and sounds, smells, and tastes, and the ways different animals exist on the planet we all share. Young blends scientific study and elegant prose to transform textbook fodder into an exciting read. 6. Constructing a Nervous System. In her second memoir, Pulitzer Prize winner Margot Jefferson brilliantly interrogates and expands the form. Jefferson oscillates between criticism and personal narrative, reflecting on performance, artistry, and the act of writing. 7. His name is George Floyd. Robert Samuels and Toulouse Olorunipa expand on their reporting on the murder of George Floyd by police officer Derek Chauvin in their biography of the former. They explore in compassionate terms how the life of a father and friend was shaped by systemic racism and how his death became a global symbol for change. 8. How Far the Light Reaches by Sabrina Imbler. Sabrina Imbler thoughtfully examines connections between science and humanity in 10 dazzling essays, each a study of a different sea creature. Throughout, Imbler reveals the surprising ways these creatures can teach us about family, sexuality, and survival. 9. The Invisible Kingdom. Megan O'Rourke's reported memoir is an indictment of the U.S. healthcare system's approach to diagnosing and treating chronic illnesses. With an empathetic hand, O'Rourke argues for why we need to change our systems to better support patients. 10. The revolutionary Pulitzer Prize winner Stacy Schiff revisits Samuel Adams' clandestine work in the years leading up to 1776 to show how vital he was to American independence, crafting an intricate portrait of a man long overshadowed by his contemporaries. Returning now to a couple more of the Annabel Guterman reviews of fiction books. 7. Young Mungo, the highly anticipated follow-up to Douglas Stewart's Shugie Bang, is another visceral depiction of late 20th century Glasgow, this time centered on the impossible first love between two teenage boys. In describing their plight, Stewart illuminates the struggles faced by queer men, choosing to follow their hearts in the face of homophobia and toxic masculinity. 8. Lesser-known monsters of the 21st century. The 12 stories that make up Kim Fu's FU bold collection feature characters dealing with scenarios that linger between reality and fantasy. In the spaces where lines blur from a girl growing wings to an insomniac being visited by a sandman, Fu points to the very human crises that sit below the surreal surface. 9. Trust. Whom can you rely on to tell a story? This question is the driving force behind Hernán Díaz's innovative novel, which features four interconnected narratives, all centered on a wealthy couple in 1920s New York. In Uncovering the Answer, Díaz writes a dazzling story about perception, greed, and marriage. 10. Signal Fires. Danny Shapiro's first novel in 15 years follows the aftermath of a fatal car accident. The details of what happened are kept secret and haunt one family forever. As Shapiro flips between past and present, she creates a moving portrait of guilt, grief, and fate to show how life is made up of moments beyond our control, and that it takes only a second for everything to change. And returning now to Judy Berman's television review page, number 7, Atlanta Season 4. In episodes that ranged from an acerbic mockumentary about a fictional black Disney CEO to a poignant camping trip romance, Atlanta's final season took a wild ride to the intersection of blackness, wealth, fame, and art-making, along with keen social commentary and surreal humor. Creator and star Donald Glover gave each of his central characters the thoughtful resolution they deserved. From FX. 8. Derry Girls. That's D-E-R-R-Y, Girls. Lisa McGee's beloved comedy about five teens growing up in trouble-stricken 1990s Northern Ireland juxtaposed the grim daily realities of a world historical conflict with the bubbly self-involvement of high schoolers, yielding one of the funniest shows you will ever see. This year's final season was a particular stunner, filled with road trip misadventures, A-list guest stars, and first love. That was from Netflix. 9. Made for Love. In a tumultuous year for tech, no satire of the industry hit harder than Alyssa Nuttig's adaptation of her own 2017 novel, which got smarter, weirder, and darker in a second and final season set within a multi-billionaire CEO's corporate HQ dream home prison. The result was a witty, trenchant, sometimes harrowing allegory for big tech's dangerous conflation of love and control. HBO Max. Finally, number 10, Rap Space, SH exclamation point T. Issa Rae's Miami set hip-hop comedy proved she does not have to be on screen to make something great. Aida Osman and Chameleon shown as old friends whose lives converge after a late-night freestyle propels them to fame as a rap duo. The regional details are on point, the songs are radio-ready, and the overall effect is as fresh as its heroine's rhymes. From HBO Max. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.